everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week RNIB's Head of Community Engagement David Aldwinkle talks about his twin passions, improving awareness of what sight loss means and reading great books.
So many misconceptions, misunderstandings, or I guess even lack of thought about what it means to be blind or partially sighted.
Author Lucinda Hawksley discusses her family connection to Charles Dickens.
He and his wife had 10 children and only one of them died in infancy, which for that time was extraordinary that they only lost one child.
Robert Kirkwood goes behind the scenes to tell the story of how talking books are made, and author and journalist Peter Ross reveals the books of his life.
And they tell the story of Parahandy, the skipper of a Clyde puffer called the Vital Spark.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. David Aldwinkle is RNIB's Head of Community Engagement. Being blind himself, he's aware of just how important it is for the charity to reflect and serve the needs of those whose interests it represents. He's also a keen reader, so I jumped at the chance to quiz him about his twin passions. So, Dave, welcome to Read On.
Nice to be here, Red.
In the introduction, I give your title as Head of Community Engagement. What exactly does that mean?
It is a little bit difficult to understand. I guess it doesn't do what it says on the tin. My job is to lead the work within RNIB, which is about understanding more and understanding better the lived experience of people with little or no sight. And we do that in a number of ways. Primarily, we're trying to build a big connected community of blind and partially sighted people, RNIB Connect, which currently stands at about 33,000 people and growing every day. But the point of doing that is to help people meet each other first and foremost, find each other, learn from each other and have a bit of fun. But beyond that, we want all of those people to really help all the staff, all the volunteers, everybody within RNIB understand the true reality of living with sight loss, and doing that through a number of ways, which might be through joining meetings, telling your story, being part of projects to develop new pieces of work, or helping us decide what our strategy and future vision should be.
And you yourself are registered blind. I believe you have Stargardt's disease?
Yes, I've been diagnosed with a whole number of names, I guess, for broadly the same thing. My most recent and actually the settled diagnosis now is Stargardt's disease. It was discovered when I was about 8 years old, purely by chance, that my sister was having her eyes looked at, and they found it in my sister, and they said, as I was there, let's have a look at him. It was two for the price of one.
And what's that mean that you can see now?
So I have no central vision at all. I have scarring across the whole of my retina in both eyes, which effectively gives a whole host. I couldn't tell you how many effectively blind spots, but there's no central vision. Lots of flashing lights in the way of where what I should be looking at is. And then lots of scarring around the rest of my vision. So even my peripheral vision is very, very limited.
And I've heard you talk quite movingly about the personal challenges of sight loss, that sense of grief, mourning, and the need to constantly reinvent yourself when you don't have a static state of sight, when it changes day to day. That obviously is a conversation that needs to come out more into the open.
Yeah, there's so many misconceptions, misunderstandings, or I guess even lack of thought about what it means to be blind or partially sighted. At the very basic level, most people in the general public either are unaware or haven't thought about what it means. And when you say you're blind, they don't understand that, you know, 93% of people who are registered blind have some useful vision. And that's just something that is a fact, but people don't associate as being actually the truth. And there's so many different experiences, 200 conditions causing sight loss, but so many different experiences in that. None of us can say we are representative of the whole community. And so my experience is very much about a deteriorating condition that has seen me have to change. And as you say, reinvent myself or find new ways to do things, to keep plugging away, to keep fighting the fight, if you like, and to keep on trying not to be defined by the fact that I can't see as well as I could or as well as other people. But my experience is one in a thousand, one in a million. You know, but I think through Connect, through the work we're doing, through encouraging people to tell their story, share their experience, we get a far broader and deeper understanding of all of those experiences. And if in doing that, we can find better solutions and we can help people learn to live, learn to cope, learn to thrive, and to kind of draw on their inner strength, the experience that everybody has, and everyone has it within them to do the things that they want to do. But we all have our challenges, I guess. And I think as an organization, as a community, as a society, we need to understand far better that those experiences are all very different.
Yes, and I think that isolation, the feelings of isolation, are one of the worst aspects of sight loss. And one of the things I've found quite reassuring is to know I'm not alone, that I haven't been singled out for the special treatment. And hearing other people's stories makes you realise that there is a community out there who can give advice that might help.
Absolutely. And the one thing I think that we can all say we have in common is that we all draw benefit and strength from somebody else who is walking a similar path. That's actually, in my view, the only thing that we all have in common. And that's good and healthy and absolutely as it should be. And that's, again, one of those myths that we need to dispel, that every blind person knows every other blind person, for a start, or we all have the same experience. There's as you were talking, Red, I'm reminded of the Police song Message in a Bottle, where I'm showing my age with that. But there's a line in that which says, I'm not alone in being alone. And I think that's a tremendous line. And actually, for the first time in my life, that's made sense to me.
One way that a lot of us connect with the outside world is clearly through books, and the jewel in the crown of R&IB arguably is the R&IB library. I know you're quite a passionate reader yourself.
I am, and I do love reading. I do love listening. I always I never know whether to say listening or reading now, because I'm using audiobooks, and more recently using the text to speech on a Kindle. I'm never sure whether to say, well, I'm listening to a book or reading a book. I prefer to say reading, I guess. So yes, I am a passionate reader now. As I was thinking about coming and speaking to you today, I was reflecting on my life, and as a child, I wasn't a passionate reader. I was very much in the, yeah, I can read another day. I'd much rather be out playing football. I'd much rather be out running around with my mates or doing anything but what felt like work. And I think I read a bit but wasn't hooked at that stage. It was only, I think, when it became difficult to read that I realised its importance to me. And finding audiobooks actually was a huge stage in my coming to terms with changes in my sight loss. Books became, unlocked a whole world to me, which I, if I'm honest, I hadn't actually realised was there. And perhaps had I not had a deterioration in sight, I still wouldn't really understand it. So it's really impacted my life hugely, being able to read and being able to unlock a whole wealth of knowledge, of understanding, of kind of consciousness that maybe I didn't have before.
And are there particular genres that you prefer listening to, or do you have a broad taste?
Fairly broad. I go through phases, I think. I used to read quite a lot of biographies, and then I realised I was getting obsessed with biographies. I have to say, I draw the line at kind of the celebrity who's been a celebrity for a year having a biography. I find that not that interesting, but you know, notable people, and particularly more recently, kind of rock biographies, actually were of great interest to me. I do read quite a lot of historical commentary, you know, adventure as well. I've read a lot of Tom Clancy, that kind of thing. I like crime books, weirdly particularly set in Edinburgh. It seems to be a particularly crime-ridden city with Rebus and others. Some of the first audio books that got me into listening to books were the Irvine Welsh, the whole series of Irvine Welsh books. So even though I think they're not as good as they used to be, I think they're when a new one is out, it's usually the next one that I download. So it's quite a broad range, and it's quite often just whatever takes my fancy.
And you mentioned that you use both text to speech and talking books, and I think certainly for
the Irvin Welsh books. Actually, they only made sense to me when somebody else was reading them to me. I found reading the dialect quite difficult.
Absolutely right. And it doesn't work with a speech synthesizer.
There will always be room for talking books.
Definitely.
Which I suppose should bring me on to the books of your life section. Mm. Was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading?
The books that really resonate and I still can almost feel were always Roald Dahl. George's Marvelous Medicine just used to make me hoot with laughter, just the idea in it. But the one that keeps coming back is Danny Champion of the World. Mm. When I think about it, I can still, there's a scene in it where he's stitching he's making tiny incisions in the sultanas and raisins, and he's putting ground up aspirin into it to drug the birds. And I can still feel those raisins. You know, I can still visualize the drive into the woods. And that's something that really just it must have been something in the language, something in the story that I just was engrossed and it hooked me. I think underlying it all with Roald Dahl is that there's a sense of anarchy and there's a sense of challenging the status quo. And it's usually kids or the underdog beating the grown-ups and beating the authority there. And I think that's probably what has resonated with me through my life, because that's kind of the thing that's always excited me and actually, if I'm honest, why I do the job I do now.
My father, without the slightest doubt, was the most marvellous and exciting father any boy ever had. You might think, if you didn't know him well, that he was a stern and serious man. He wasn't. He was actually a wildly funny person. What made him appear so serious was the fact that he never smiled with his mouth. He did it all with his eyes. He had brilliant blue eyes, and when he thought of something funny, his eyes would flash, and if you look carefully, you could actually see a tiny little golden spark dancing in the middle of each eye. But the mouth never moved. I was glad my father was an eye smiler. It meant he never gave me a fake smile, because it's impossible to make your eyes twinkle if you aren't feeling twinkly yourself.
David Thorpe narrating Roald Dahl's Danny, the Champion of the World, which is TB14707. And is there a book that on a rainy day with nothing else to do, you'd like to curl up with and reread?
The book that I go back to, and I must have gone back to it 20 or 25 times now, is a book called Cultural Amnesia. And it's a collection of essays by Clive James. And part of the interest is that Clive James was always someone that I enjoyed reading. And he narrates it and I just enjoy listening to him. But the book is subtitled Notes in the Margins of History. And it's essentially a book of essays about people from history, cultural giants, some people I'd never heard of, politicians through the 20th century, I guess. And I think what he's trying to say in it is that despite the best efforts of men to destroy the world or to destroy society or to impose a view, the arts, literature, culture thrive and join humanity across philosophical boundaries, across geographic boundaries, and actually are the kind of the heartbeat of humanity, and will always thrive and will always come back. And I find that really life-affirming. And it's so it couples just a very good prose style. And I do come away learning something. Every time I've read it, I've picked up something about a person I'd never heard of, which then leads me to another book or leads me to go and look for something else, which is something I like about reading, is that you read a line and you think, I might go and have a look at that then. So it always takes me somewhere else, but ultimately it just affirms my belief in humanity.
Unfortunately, Cultural Amnesia is not in the R&IB library, but many of Clive James's other books are, including all 5 volumes of his unreliable memoirs.
My mother and I were having breakfast. I heard the Danny man's footsteps thumping along the driveway with a silent pause as he hurdled my bicycle, which in my habitual carelessness I had left lying there. I heard the usual thumps, bangs and heaves. I could picture the brimming pan, secured with the special clipped lid, hoisted high on his shoulder while he held my mother's gift bottle of beer in his other appreciative hand. Then The footsteps started running back the other way. Whether he forgot about my bicycle or simply mistimed his jump, there was no way of telling. Suddenly there was the noise of... well, it was mainly the noise of a dunny man running full tilt into a bicycle. The uproar was made especially ominous by the additional noise, tiny but significant in context, of a clipped lid springing off. While my mother sat there with her hands over her eyes, I raced out through the fly-screen door and took a look down the driveway. The dunny man, overwhelmed by the magnitude of his tragedy, had not yet risen to his feet. Needless to say, the contents of the pan had been fully divulged. All the stuff had come out. But what was really remarkable was the way none of it had missed him.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Can I be greedy and have two?
Oh, go on, since it's you.
So the book I've just finished is called The Long Road from Jarrow, and it's by Stuart McConey. And it's the journalist Stuart McConey retracing the Jarrow March, walking from Jarrow to London and talking about the Jarrow March, but using it as a reflection on modern day Britain. And just the thread of it running through the changing landscape, the changing culture of the country and the nature of people as you move what are essentially very short distances across the country, I found fascinating. And I find his writing and reading style really engaging. So that's one I would I'd like more people to pick up and have a listen to. And the other one is the new rewriting of the Greek myths by Stephen Fry, The Mythos, which, again, Stephen Fry I find very good to listen to. I hadn't read the Greek myths, the Greek legends for, you know, since I was probably at school. They were exciting because they're about battles and they're about one god smiting another, which was all very exciting when I was 10 or 11. But I think the retelling that Stephen Fry has done really brings out the kind of the romance of those stories. And I find that was a new angle on it, which I found really compelling and actually, you know, obviously far more interesting than which god did what to which other god. But the romance, the sadness, the joy, the love that goes through those stories, I found, again, really quite life-affirming. And there are kind of threads there that run, that talk about humanity being, you know, it's, we're fairly constant, we're fairly simple beings. And I think it comes out in those stories.
David Albwinkle, thank you so much for some inspirational books of your life and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you for having me.
Both The Long Road to Jarrow by Stuart McConey and Stephen Fry's Mythos are available commercially as audiobooks. Thanks again to David Albwinkle. To find out how to join the Connect community, visit rnib.org.uk or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB's compendium of the best in books. Coming up later in today's show, Robert Kirkwood goes behind the scenes to bring us the story of the making of a talking book. But first, Lucinda Hawksley is an author of historical biography. She specialises in the Victorian era. She's also the great-great-great-granddaughter of Charles Dickens. Her latest book, March, Women March, has just entered the RNIB library. In the centenary of women getting the vote, it examines the long history of women's suffrage. Here's an extract covering the funeral of Emily Davidson, who died beneath the hooves of the King's Horse in the 1913 Derby, protesting for the vote.
The day of Davidson's funeral was marked by the solemn splendour of a procession of mourning women. Many of the suffragettes had never met Davidson, but they travelled to London to pay their respects to the woman who had died for their cause. The WSPU had sent out a circular letter to other suffrage societies inviting them to attend the funeral. June 11th, 1913. Dear Secretary, the body of Miss Emily Wilding Davidson will be taken across London on Saturday from Victoria to King's Cross. Your society will probably feel it an honour to take part in the procession and in this way to testify to their reverence of this woman who has laid down her life for the cause we all have at heart. The prevailing colour of the procession will be purple, and you are invited to veil your banner with that colour. Any wreaths bought should be carried by your representatives. White, purple or black should be worn, and a black band on the left arm, 2 inches in depth. The funeral took place on Saturday the 14th of June. It was estimated that at least 6,000 women marched in memory of the dead suffragette. Rebecca West wrote of the funeral, "If, when we walked behind her on Saturday, we thought of ourselves as doing a dead comrade honour, we were wrong. We were making a march of penitence behind a victim we allowed the government to do to death."
Harriet Dunlop narrating March, Women March by Lucinda Hawksley, who spoke to RNIB reporter Claire Carson.
So I'm delighted to welcome into the studio Lucinda Hawksley. So Lucinda, first of all, we're going to start by this incredible work, March, Women, March. Tell us about the book.
Well, it came out really because my publishers asked if I would write a book on the suffragettes. But actually, I had been doing a lot of work with female artists from the 19th century. And I said, I'd love to write a book on suffrage, but the suffragettes were actually really late. That's not until the 20th century. And there was so much campaigning going on all through the 19th century and earlier. So really what I wanted to do was to look at the women's movement in general and how it ended up with getting the vote.
So it is an incredible story. It's almost like a tapestry when I read it and pieced together, you know, right, as you say, across the centuries, almost 150 years of campaigning.
Yes.
Did you find it very emotional researching?
I did. I found it very emotional. And it made me feel very angry at times. It made me feel very relieved at other times. And first of all, the question was when to begin, because really you could start with Boudicca. I mean, when do you begin the search for the women's movement in Britain? But I decided eventually that the starting point would have to be the publication at the end of the 18th century of Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women. So that seemed like the most obvious thing. And it was also very interesting to discover that then suffrage applied to men and women. And at that time, in the 1790s, only 3% of the male population of this country had the vote. So that's 100% of women and 97% of men had no legal voice at all, no political voice. And it really starts to escalate from then on as men gradually start to get enfranchised, as it kind of seeps down the social classes and with the Industrial Revolution. Of course, the middle classes start to rise and people start to make more money. And men suddenly all start to get more power. So initially, the suffrage movement was very much an equal movement between men and women struggling for recognition from this tiny 3% at the top who were in power. And really, in fact, as suffrage starts to get more prominent and more men get emancipated, the role of women just gets pushed further down. So women in this country had more freedom in the 18th century than they did in the 19th century. Ironically, under Queen Victoria, the position of women goes back so far. It's really quite surprising.
I find it a very humbling read to realise actually how much freedom I do have now that I just take for granted. And I love the fact that it is each voice is a standalone voice, and yet when the voices come together, it makes one big difference.
It really does. And one of the things that struck me most when I'd been researching my biographies, when I'd first started thinking about the women's movement as a possible book, it was these women and men who campaigned for future generations. So most of these women who were campaigning for things like rights to see their children, all of these kind of things that we just take for granted, they did it knowing it probably wasn't going to happen in their own lifetime. But they were doing it to benefit their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. They had such passion and compassion for people of our generation. And I find that amazing.
Social reform is a wonderful thread through all of your books.
Yeah.
Is that something that you do glean from your great-great-great-grandfather Charles Dickens? Because the social reform that he was writing about was set so clearly in his real classics.
Yes, I've never thought of it in that way. Actually, that's quite funny. I'm very passionate about it, so I guess that's why it comes across. And when you're writing about the 19th century, which the kind of majority of my books are set in, or at least begin in the 19th century, the need for social reform was huge and the zeal was really there. And now it does feel very much as if we're back in that. I feel a lot when I read newspapers or whatever, there's a lot of commentary, particularly since the film I Am Daniel Blake, for example. People are talking a great deal about the need for philanthropists. People contact me on Twitter a lot saying we need Dickens to sort this out. You know, people still look at Dickens as being the great social reformer. Isn't that a bit sad? He died in 1870. They were nearly at the 150th anniversary of his death. And people still feel that there haven't been that many great social reformers since, apart from the wonderful Nye Bevan, obviously. But, you know, there's so much need still. But when you're writing about the 19th century, you cannot ignore social reform because it's in everything.
Do you have any favourite stories of Charles Dickens?
In terms of social reform, probably one of my favourite ones is something people probably aren't aware of as much as his other work, which is that he was one of the people behind the founding of Great Ormond Street Hospital. And when I say that, he wasn't the founder, but they came to him and said, we want to found a hospital for children. There was no hospital for children. And one in three children in London was dying at this point. This was the 1850s. And it was a very poignant time in Dickens' life because his own daughter had just died. He and his wife had 10 children and only one of them died in infancy, which for that time was extraordinary that they only lost one child out of a family of 10. But he was really devastated by this. And when they came to him at this moment in his life, it was very kind of serendipitous. And so he worked with them. And what he did was he wrote an article about the need for a children's hospital and the fact that this was very radical because it would train nurses specifically in children's care, which had never been done before. And most people didn't take people to hospital at that time unless it was a last resort. Hospitals were really seen as a place you went to die because nursing was done at home. Hospitals were places where you went if you were too infectious to be nursed at home or if you had no one to take care of you. And so this was a whole new idea in hospital care. And Dickens wrote an article about it and it was incredible. And 6 years later, they went back to him and said, we're too successful. Your article and the fundraising, the raising of awareness that you've done has made so many people bring their children to us that we're bursting at the seams and we're going to fold. So in 1858, he held a fundraising dinner. And at that dinner and through his campaigning zeal, in 1858, he allegedly raised £3,000, which was an absolute fortune. So they bought the building next door. And that's the original Great Ormond Street Hospital, which if you're in London, that's the hospital that you would visit. But most people aren't aware that he helped that. And then, of course, the great J.M. Barrie gave the copyrights and the royalties from Peter Pan. So two authors helped to build and keep that hospital going, which I think is quite cool.
Looking ahead to what happens next. So you've just been to New Zealand. And what is next in store for you, Lucinda?
Well, actually, I finished a book just before I went to New Zealand, which is on Charles Dickens and Christmas, which is coming out, I think it's the beginning of November, could be the end of October this year. And it sounds as if it's something that's been done a lot. But interestingly, it's always been about Dickens and Christmas Carol. And as many people are probably aware, he wrote 5 Christmas books in total, dozens and dozens of Christmas stories, Christmas scenes in many of his novels. And also the book focuses on his Christmas letters, of which he wrote many, and his own family Christmases. His Christmases from 1812 when he was born, what it was like to be a child growing up in, you know, those kind of Christmases in from 1812 onwards up until the end of his life in 1870. And it's so interesting to see the development of Christmas. And the history of Christmas is something I've long been interested in. Dickens is often attributed with having invented Christmas. And that's apocryphal. But he caught the zeitgeist, the mood of the moment. And he really created the Christmas story that became so immensely popular in the 19th century and today. If you look at, you know, kind of Kindle books, if you look on Audible, you will find so many Christmas stories that are written very specifically for that market, because there's still a passion for people to read something set at Christmas time. And writing the book was just a really interesting way of studying both the history of Christmas and Dickens's own journey between the man who loved Christmas. And Christmas Carol is enormous, and he's so full of excitement, and it's never been out of print, and I think it's one of the best things ever written, to the Christmas industry that he unwittingly spawned and was dogged by, and every year had to produce something else, and by the end was finding Christmas really quite miserable because it had become his busiest time of year and he was never able to spend it with his family.
What an irony. Thanks very much to Lucinda Hawksley for coming into the studio and telling us about her books. Books we have available in our library include March Women March on TB23084. Lizzie Siddle, The Tragedy of a Pre-Raphaelite Supermodel, is available in Braille. The Mystery of Princess Louise is available in Talking Book, Braille and Giant Print. And Katie, The Life and Loves of Dickens, Artist Daughter, is coming soon in Talking Book.
Thanks to Lucinda Hawksley and Claire Carson. And while we're on the subject of great stories to tell, don't forget that this year's RNIB Connect Creative Writing Competition is now open for entries. The theme this year, as chosen by a panel of Connect community members, is Connections. The competition is open to anyone with sight loss, and you're invited to respond to the theme in no more than 1,000 words of prose or 30 lines of poetry by Monday, March the 5th. For more details, phone Talk and Support on 0207 391 2218, or just search for RNIB Writing Competition and it should be the first result. And remember, your entry can be in whichever accessible format you prefer to use.
RNIB, supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away, with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up soon, the books of Peter Ross's life. But before that, for many of us, talking books are such a feature of our everyday lives that we might almost take them for granted. But as Robert Kirkwood found out, each book has its own backstory.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Breakfast at Tiffany's and Other Stories by Truman Capote.
179. Gulliver's Travels. Here is a brief description of the book.
This book has four chapters and is on one CD.
Read by Nicholas Courtney, it lasts 9 hours and 13 minutes.
A powerful satire on mankind, morals and social habits, written in the form of Travels in Wonderland.
Talking book number 13047.
One question I get a lot when I tell people what I do and what I used to do at RNIB Talking Books is something I thought was pretty obvious. How is a talking book made? But when you try to answer the question, you realise it's not as simple as a narrator talking into a microphone. Who casts the actors? How is it read by a daisy player? And who chooses the books in the first place? Well, let's find out.
Holly-go-lightly is generally up all night drinking cocktails and breaking hearts.
Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats by T.S. Eliot.
Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin.
This is a daisy recording and has one level of navigation to indicate the start of each chapter.
Disc 1. This book is on two discs.
So each month, NLS and Products and Publications come together to form the Book Selection Committee.
Darrell Chapman, RNIB Talking Books Studio Manager.
So what happens here in these meetings is they look at various things. So primarily members' requests, of course, are a key factor in determining what gets selected. What's popular? If there's anything such as the Booker Awards that have come out, the short or long list, then obviously that will inform what it is that they're going to be looking at selecting, and just various things that are going on in the marketplace. They'll then come up with a list of approximately 50 titles per month, which they wish to have produced in an audio format, and those titles are sent to us.
So the book's sent to us, and the first thing I do is I go through each book, speed read each title so that I can find out who I'm going to cast the book to.
Senior producer Rupert Morgan.
Now, what I'm looking for is whether the book is first person, third person, whether it's set in a specific place. If it's first person, obviously whether it's male or female, and what voice type I need based on locality, nationality, American, African, who knows. And then what I'm trying to do is to match the book to the best available narrator. So I'll go through my list of nearly 400 narrators who are on the panel, working out who would be best, and also who, if there's been a reader reading the book, a series of books perhaps, try to keep the same narrator on that book. It's not always possible. It depends on people's availability. That narrator may already be reading another book. So it's a case of working out who would be best and trying to match the book to the artist. So when it comes to issues such as pronunciations, what I'll do is I'll go through the book. When I'm speed reading through, I'm looking out for things like if there are place names, or if the book's set in a particular place, there may be a narrator who has a certain knowledge, and I'll know that. I've got that part of my database. I'll have that listed. It could, however, be that the right voice, just that person wouldn't necessarily have that knowledge. And then the way we do it is it's a collaboration between me and the narrators. If the narrator will do some research and do what they can, and anything they can't find, they'll then come back to me. If I can find it for myself, I'll do so. And you know, I've got various reference titles, and obviously there's online resources. However, sometimes you're into areas of real special knowledge, and then I'll go and source an expert in the field who can hopefully volunteer to help us.
So I get a book, and I take that book home, and I start to read it.
Audiobooks narrator and commercial producer with Story Circle, Gary Kagan.
And then if I don't really understand it, I read it again. Then I take a pencil, and I start to mark it. I mark the characters with an initial. And then I have little kind of tiny marks to mark stresses. Is this going up on this syllable or down in the end? Is this a phrase in which I draw a little circle above to join the words together? So I can see it coming so that I know roughly where I'm going to go with the kind of intonation of a sentence or a paragraph. I mark pauses, and sometimes I mark breaths if there's a long phrase coming up. So a lot of detailed work goes on the page so that I can see it as I'm reading along in the studio.
And then we start recording.
Audio producer Ross Berman.
Which is a long, slow process. It's about... I always say it's more of a marathon than a sprint.
Robert moved back and looked up at that. Sir Howard made a coughing assent, nodding vigorously. Robert moved back and looked up the hatch. No one appeared to be there.
On guard!
Robert shouted.
Too loud.
I'm sending him up!
Too loud, I'm afraid.
No one appeared to be there.
On guard!
Robert shouted.
I'm sending him up!
It's about finding a right rhythm for the book and putting them in a comfortable position so they can sit and read and then if they stop or they make a mistake or I stop them for a noise or they've read something wrong, then we agree a point to go back. Then I play them in so they hear themselves playing up to that point, and then they carry on
seamlessly, and then we end up on our systems with a complete correct version of the text that we're recording.
Get me out, the voice moaned. Get me out, get me out! Hurry! Robert opened the door. It was too dark to see much of the... Hurry! Robert opened the door. It was too dark to see much of the figure that crawled from the box, which Robert considered a blessing.
And as we go on, that gets faster and faster, so we're not, we don't stop and have a discussion so much. We can just drop them in. And occasionally I'll stop them and say, you know, I think that can be a bit louder, a bit quieter. I think, you know, he should be angry at this point. Or we talk about various things. And the main thing we do is try and make it a pleasurable experience for all round, because you get a better end product if everyone's happy.
And then, of course, it's all up to fate and good fortune to read smoothly in the studio and have a nice producer or an engineer on the other side of the glass, so he keeps me happy and I keep him happy. Normally I would do roughly 110 pages a day. My wife can do 140, but we try not to make comparisons.
This is a Daisy recording and has two levels of navigation. Level 1 navigates to the title page, prologue, the named sections, and the appendix. Level 2 navigates to the section about the author, the dedication, the headings within the appendix, and the acknowledgements.
So the book has been recorded in our studios.
Senior audio engineer, Oliver Johnson.
And then we bring those files into a software program, which essentially creates the Daisy book for us. We add in tags that allow the end user to navigate the book either via chapters or via parts, and also via pages as well. The software also adds in phrase detection, so if the narrator reading the book pauses, that will become a new phrase. So the end user can then navigate the book as if it were a print copy, so that they can navigate by chapters, by parts, by pages, and also by sentence and paragraph.
Disc Daisy title, Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery. Phrase. Page. Level 1. Chapter 1. There are plenty of people in Avonlea and out of it. The orchard on the slope below the house was in a bridal flush of pinky-white bloom, hummed over by a myriad of bees. Set bookmark 1. Are you sure? Enter. Setting bookmark 1. The task has been completed.
The room in here, we have 15 CD duplication, CDR duplication systems. They have 600 media waiting to be burnt.
Martin Pugh at RNIB Peterborough, where the Talking Book CDs are made and sent from.
A request is sent via our customer response centre, which is also here at Peterborough. The software looks at a customer selection list. It will then send a message to one of these automated CD duplication systems here. The system will pick up a blank media and put it in one of the burning trays here, and it writes the story. It pulls from a storage device the file of a book. It can be on anything you like, War and Peace. It will pull forward the War and Peace file to this machine, and it will burn that onto the CDR. It will then burn, as I say, in the tray. You see the noise you hear now is one coming out after being burnt. And the robotic arm on the system has lifted it up and it is putting it in a Rimarch printer. So the noise you can now hear is the CD being printed. Each one of these spindles of 600 contains 200 CDRs. So as it moves across, a complete spindle will contain 200 finished talking books with addresses and titles on. The spindle is removable, so you pick it up off the machine and you move it over to the auto pack and slide the spindle into the auto packer, and it is then placed in an envelope. Now when it's been read by the customer, it is reversed, so all you can see is the shiny side of the CDR, and on the back of the Velcro the Velcro sealed cardboard envelope is the return address here at Peterborough, and the Royal Mail deliver it back to us.
The CDs are one use only, so what happens when they're returned?
We're looking at now a large bin that's full of what is now scrap CDRs. These CDRs are granulated, and the granules are then recycled and used in other things like flower pots. The last lot went to a road building scheme in China. So they're all reused somewhere on the planet. All of our CDRs are reused to make it as green a process as we possibly can. And that applies to the envelopes as well. They're all recycled or reused.
So from selection to casting to recording to burning to listening to recycling. That's how a talking book is made.
We hope you have enjoyed this talking book. If you'd like more titles by the same author, or maybe other books of a similar style, please contact RNIB Customer Services. Please return this CD to the library in the packaging provided. Upon our receipt of this CD, your next title will be dispatched.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and everybody at RNIB Talking Books for that report and for making so many wonderful books accessible. And now it's time for Books of Your Life. Three book recommendations from my guest, typically one from childhood, a rainy day comfort read, and one that they've read recently that they'd like to share. Peter Ross is an award-winning author and journalist with a wonderful eye for human interest stories. He's published two collections of his work, Dawnderlust and, most recently, The Passion of Harry Bingo, gathering together fascinating, insightful tales that might otherwise slip beneath the radar. He joined me down the line from our Glasgow studio. So, Peter, was there a book that you read as a young man that made you fall in love with writing?
Yeah, I think George Orwell's 1984 was probably the first book I read during which I was conscious that I was reading something called literature rather than just a story. I mean, clearly it was a book that had kind of meaning and a serious purpose, and it had a real aesthetic beauty to its language too. And I think it was probably in my mid-teens when I read it, maybe 15 or 16. And in some ways, it's a book that suits a teenage boy because it has sex in it, has violence in it, quite a clear sense of goodies and baddies. And it's also very easy to read. You know, Orwell's language is always accessible, and he keeps the story moving along at a fair clip, so it's never boring. I mean, I'm 44 now, and I've read it several times over the last 30 years, including studying the book at university. And then very recently, writing about it in an essay that I wrote for the Boston Review about 1984 in the age of Donald Trump. And as part of that story, I was lucky enough to be able to visit the island of Jura in the Hebrides, where Orwell actually wrote most of the book in 1946 and 1947, while he was dying, actually, from tuberculosis. And the family who owns the house where he wrote it allowed me to go into what had been his bedroom and look out at the view he must have seen when he looked up from his typewriter through that kind of dreich blur of the rain toward the kind of whaleback hump of mainland Scotland. And it struck me that even though he was seeing that with his eyes, his mind at that time must have been really far away and in room 101 with the rats and so on. But the best thing of all was that the roof of the house where he wrote it, the house is called Barnhill, had recently been replaced. So I took a piece of the old slate with me. And that was the slate that kept the rain off Orwell when he was writing 1984. And it kept his fag smoke in. And I have it on my desk now at home. And I don't think any writer of non-fiction or fiction, really, could hope for a more powerful talisman than that.
It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Winston Smith, his chin nuzzled into his breast in an effort to escape the vile wind, slipped quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering along with him. The hallway smelt of boiled cabbage and old rag mats. At one end of it, a coloured poster, too large for indoor display, had been tacked to the wall. It depicted simply an enormous face, more than a meter wide. The face of a man of about 45, with a heavy black moustache and ruggedly handsome features. Winston made for the stairs. It was no use trying the lift. Even at the best of times, it was seldom working, and at present the electric current was cut off during daylight hours. It was part of the economy drive in preparation for Hate Week. The flat was 7 flights up, and Winston, who was 39 and had a varicose ulcer above his right ankle, went slowly, resting several times on the way. On each landing, opposite the lift shaft, the poster with the enormous face gazed from the wall. It was one of those pictures which are so contrived that the eyes follow you about when you move. Big Brother is watching you, the caption beneath it ran.
1984 is available from the RNIB library in Braille, giant print, and as TB21744. And is there a book that you'd like to curl up with and reread on a rainy day?
Yeah. I mean, all of the three books that I've chosen to talk to you about have a West Coast of Scotland connection. And this one, again, is a book that I first read as a child. It's Neil Munro's Parahandy Tales, which I first discovered on my maternal grandfather's bookcase when I was about 10 years old. I was living near Alloa at that time, and I had no idea at all about the geography of the Clyde Coast. So places mentioned in the stories, like Dunoon or Tynabruach, sounded tremendously exotic to me. And for those who don't know the stories, they were written by Neil Munro, who, like George Orwell, was a journalist as well as a writer of fiction. And he wrote those pieces for the Glasgow Evening News between 1905 and 1923. And they were later collected in book form. And they tell the story of Parahandy, the skipper of a Clyde puffer called the Vital Spark, and his crew, who are Doogie McPhail, the Tar, and Sonny Jim. And they're comic stories. And what I find kind of amazing and admirable is that considering their age, they're still amazingly fresh and funny. They've got a tremendously wry and gentle sense of humour. The characters are extremely vivid. And I think their tone, which is a kind of compassionate cheekiness, if I can put it that way, has actually had another kind of big influence on my own work. I just love the Parahandy Tales. I think, you know, you're talking about curling up and reading them on a rainy day. I think the Parahandy Tales are like a hot toddy. They're just the thing to kind of warm you up in the winter.
And by that sign, and by his red beard, and by a curious gesture he had, as if he were now and then going to scratch his ear, and only determined not to do it when his hand was up, I knew he was one of the Macfarlanes. There were 10 Macfarlanes, all men except one, and he was a valley. But the family did their best to conceal the fact, and said he was away on the yachts, and making that much money he had not time to write a scrape home. "I think I ought to know you," I said to the vocalist with the hard hat. "You are a Macfarlane, either the Beacon, or Kale, or the Nipper, or Keep Dark, or Parahandy." "As sure as death," said he, "I'm just Parahandy. And I ken your name fine, but I cannot just mind your face."
The wonderful Crawford Logan narrating Neil Munro's The Vital Spark, which is TB13511. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, my favourite book, probably of the last year, was the Seabird's Cry by Adam Nicholson. People may know Adam Nicholson as the author of 2001's The Sea Room, which was a best-selling history of the Shants, which are three small Hebridean islands which his family own. This new book, The Seabird's Cry, is a celebration of the lives and loves of seabirds, but it's also a lament for the struggles that so many of them are having in the face of global warming and pollution and all that sort of man-made destruction. So 10 of the 12 chapters are dedicated to a different bird, Fulmer, Puffin, Kittiwake, Guillemot, Razorbill, and so on. And he writes brilliantly about them. I don't think I've ever read better descriptive writing about birds. The chapter on the gannets of the Bass Rock in particular is just astonishingly good, and I'm jealous of it. It's so good. It's rather an unsettling book to read because on the one hand there's the deep pleasure of the language and Nicholson's vivid portraits of birds, but on the other it's a deeply pessimistic book when it comes to the question of the future survival of many of these species. He points out, for instance, that over the last 60 years the global population of seabirds has dropped by 2/3, and the graph actually trends to zero by 2060. So Nicholson leaves the reader in no doubt that this is our fault. And so the feeling of the reading of this book is odd and not altogether pleasant mixture of kind of delight, but also kind of guilt and grief. And it certainly made a huge impact on me this year.
We have forgotten the rawness of these animals. We want to imagine that their inner beings are as beautiful as their appearance in the world, or that they might have the same attitude to us as we, in our late, careful, conservationist way, have towards them. The best of us, if we are lucky, will behave like Mike Buckland, with his gentle, generous, attentive tolerance. But we fantasize a global love, and forget that unaccommodation, the refusal to allow, anti-forgiveness and anti-understanding are the foundations of a seabird's world. If you look into the pale ice-blue blank of a gannet's eye, you see something beyond our world. They act to their own principles and are not to be understood as decorative or charming elements in ours. They live in a violently difficult environment. Their dictates are both strange to us and weirdly familiar, versions of our own habits translated into a language we will only ever struggle to understand.
The Seabird's Cry, written by Adam Nicholson and narrated by Dugald Bruce Lockhart, is TB701921. Peter Ross, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Peter Ross. His latest book, The Passion of Harry Bingo, is out now in print and ebook, with plans for an audio version soon. And don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.